On this edition for Sunday, December 1st, severe weather snarls traffic across the U.S. For World AIDS Day, how inequality impacts those living with HIV. And in our signature segment, the digital disruption of singer Mac DeMarco. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
From the Tisch WNET studios at Lincoln Center in New York, Allison Stewart.
Good evening and thank you for joining us. A powerful winter storm is sweeping into the Northeast and making travel difficult as the Thanksgiving weekend comes to a close. Across the upper Midwest, heavy snow and wind caused highway closings and flight cancellations last night and today. Blizzard conditions caused power outages and authorities issued a no-travel advisory after 20 inches of snow fell in Duluth, Minnesota. The snow, rain, and ice made its way into the Northeast this morning, and more is expected through tomorrow. The National Weather Service issued winter storm warnings for New England and New York State, predicting more than a foot of snow in parts of the region. And severe weather may have contributed to a plane crash in South Dakota yesterday. 9 people died and 3 were injured when a single-engine plane crashed shortly after takeoff about 140 miles west of Sioux Falls. Tomorrow, members of the House Intelligence Committee will begin privately reviewing the final report from the impeachment inquiry. Late yesterday, the Intelligence Committee added a hearing for Tuesday to consider and vote on approving and sending the report to the House Judiciary Committee. The findings from the depositions and public hearings on President Trump's dealings with Ukraine will be the basis for the committee's decision on formal articles of impeachment. On Wednesday, the Judiciary Committee has scheduled a public hearing to consider the historical and constitutional standards for impeachment. President Trump and his attorneys are invited to participate, but the president will be in London for the NATO summit. On the eve of a 2-week climate conference, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called international efforts to reduce carbon emissions under the 2015 Paris Accord, quote, utterly inadequate. Guterres urged leaders to pledge to reduce greenhouse gases to reach carbon neutrality by 2050.
We are confronted now with a global climate crisis. And the point of no return is no longer over the horizon. It is in sight and hurtling towards us.
25,000 delegates from almost 200 countries are expected to attend the conference in Madrid. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced yesterday she will lead a U.S. congressional delegation. Last month, the Trump administration officially notified the U.N. that the U.S. would withdraw from the 2015 Paris Agreement. In Mexico, about 40 miles southwest of the border town of Eagle Pass, Texas, at least 21 people died after alleged drug cartel gunmen in a convoy of pickup trucks opened fire on the town of Villa Union yesterday. During an hour-long standoff, at least 10 of the suspected cartel gunmen and 4 police officers were killed. Officials said police later chased down and killed at least 7 more attackers this morning. Government buildings, including the town's municipal office, were left riddled with bullet holes, and some who were at the mayor's office are still missing. In an interview broadcast last Tuesday, President Trump said he plans to designate the cartels as terrorist organizations. On Friday, Mexico's President Andrés Manuel López Obrador said he would not accept any foreign intervention in Mexico. In London today, police identified the second victim in Friday's terror attack as 23-year-old Saskia Jones. Jones was a graduate of the University of Cambridge and, like the other victim, Jack Merritt, she was participating in a conference for students and prisoners when the violence began. 3 people were also injured in the attack. 1 was released from the hospital, and the 2 others are reportedly in stable condition. A winter storm threatens to bring a foot of snow to parts of the Northeast. Visit pbs.org/newshour for the latest. Today marks World AIDS Day, and while there has been significant progress in medical treatment and management for the nearly 38 million people globally who live with the virus, an estimated 1.7 million people were newly infected last year. Celeste Watkins-Hayes is a professor of sociology and African American studies at Northwestern University and faculty fellow at the Institute for Policy Research. She spent more than a decade researching inequality and the circumstances under which women contract and live with the virus. She's author of the book Remaking a Life: How Women Living with HIV/AIDS Confront Inequality, and she joins me now from Detroit, Michigan. In your work and in your writing, you contextualize HIV/AIDS not just as a disease, but as you write, a, quote, injury of inequality. Would you explain that concept?
It's important to understand that while HIV can affect any of us, it disproportionately affects those who are grappling with other injuries of inequality, those big and small wounds to our bodies, to our families, to our communities that disproportionately affect our health outcomes. So whether we're talking about people of color, sexual minorities, low-income folks, transgender individuals, we know that people who are at the quote-unquote bottom of society's ladder are often at highest risk for contracting an illness like HIV. Now, why is that? Part of that is because of the social context of risk and the ways in which limited access to healthcare, limited access to resources economically to take care of oneself, and limited access to medication make it difficult for people living with HIV and those at higher risk of contracting the illness to protect themselves.
When you think about the safety nets that we need for HIV and AIDS, what do those look like?
Well, the HIV community has, over the last 30 years, built a very strong safety net for people living with HIV and for those at higher risk. And it's comprised of four things. Number one, the HIV community has pushed very strongly for access to health care for people living with HIV. So when we think about the Ryan White Care Act, when we think about the AIDS Drug Assistance Program, those policies provide health care access and also medicines to people living with HIV. The second thing that the HIV community has done very effectively is to build a very strong support network for people living with HIV. So whether it's support groups or case management or the opportunity to be led by peer mentors, a community forms around people living with HIV to really offer the social support that they need to battle with their diagnosis and to battle the stigma that it brings. The third thing that the community does is it provides an on-ramp to political and civic engagement. So when we look at the HIV activists all the way back to the 1980s, they have built an ongoing legacy of community and political activism, where they are speaking truth to power and engaging our politicians to make sure that the fight continues around HIV. And the last thing that the HIV safety net is thinking about is economic sustainability. If you don't have food, housing, affordability in terms of all of the life's basic needs, you're not going to be able to maintain your health. So the HIV community has very effectively lobbied for ways for people living with HIV to get access to services and also to get access to assistance that can lead to economic and financial self-sustainability.
Where in this country does there need to be more work done? What region of the country?
Certainly in the South. So when we look at the strength of the HIV safety net, we know that it's pretty robust, although it can always be strengthened, but it's pretty robust in our major cities. But where we have really seen the safety net falter is in the South. That's for a couple of reasons. There hasn't been, although there's been activism, there hasn't been necessarily the strength of the attention around the activism for the HIV work being done. It hasn't necessarily hit our evening news in the ways that it has hit our news in D.C. and New York and San Francisco and other major cities. So the South has kind of languished due to a lack of attention, lack of resources, but also a reluctance on some policymakers to expand healthcare access to people in those regions of the country in ways that have affected what we now see in terms of rising HIV infection rates in the South.
One of the things I know that's important to you in your research and your writing is the language that we use around HIV/AIDS. Instead of saying living with or dying from, you say we should think about it as thriving despite. Talk to me why language is so important.
So the language of thriving despite is very important because it reflects our scientific moment in the epidemic. Many people who receive an HIV diagnosis believe that they have a death sentence, but due to the medical advances, people now find that if they take their medications as prescribed and reach undetectable viral loads, they can't sexually transmit the virus, and they are much more likely to have full life expectancies. So really, when we're talking about HIV, it's not about dying from HIV. It's about how do you get to a place where you can live with HIV through medications and through taking care of one's health to thriving despite, where one can really have all of the full experiences and advantages at life due to the medications. Our key now is making sure that in terms of access and affordability, people have access and opportunities to move along that trajectory from dying from to living with to thriving despite an HIV diagnosis.
Professor Celeste Watkins-Hayes, thank you so much for being with us.
It's wonderful to be with you, Allison. Thank you so much for having me.
Last month, a trove of leaked documents revealed an exceptional inside view of China's mass detention of ethnic minorities in northwest China and its growing complex of internment camps. Hundreds of pages of documents obtained by the New York Times revealed internal speeches from President Xi Jinping, as well as directives from senior officials on how to manage indoctrination camps. Additional leaked documents were later given to other journalists detailing how, in the past 3 years, Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities have been detained for ideological transformation and were kept isolated from the outside world. NewsHour Weekend's Hari Srinivasan recently spoke about those findings with Austin Ramsey, one of the reporters from the New York Times who first broke the story.
We received 400 pages of internal documents describing the history of how these camps came about. It showed that Xi Jinping, Chinese president, had been looking for some sort of answer to problems of separatism and religious extremism in Xinjiang. And so 5 years ago, he gave some very tough speeches. Shortly after that, we began to see some small camps. And then in 2017, the growth of these indoctrination camps really takes off. It really clashes with the public face that the government has tried to put on these facilities, that they're simply boarding schools for people who may have committed some sort of minor infraction and a way to give them some job training and help them move on to better lives. And in these internal documents, we can see a lot of the harm that's done to families, children who have their parents taken away.
You even point out that there are basically scripts to deal with the questions that families will have when one of their family members is mysteriously vanished.
Yes, that was perhaps the most revealing document in all of the things that we received. It was a sort of a sample Q&A for officials to handle students who were studying in other parts of China and then return home to learn that their parents or other family members were in camp. And the document is full of this sort of pseudo-medical language describing the family member as someone whose thinking has been infected, and so they needed to be put in treatment and cured.
What are they doing in these camps? How are they actually structuring these places? The ones that they said are just for re-education or vocational experience. What are these new documents revealing that tell us that that's not really the case?
These documents include one incredibly interesting 9-page document that's a set of orders that was sent out in 2017 of how camps should be run. It really describes a sort of prison-like situation. And in fact, some of the language is exactly the same as is used in prisons in Xinjiang in terms of preventing escapes and preventing incidents and things like that. Very strict controls on people on the inside, orders to have people monitor each other or essentially spy on each other. And so these documents, this document in particular, is probably the most detailed look we have at how the camps are run.
So give me an idea. I know it's hard to pin down an exact number, but how many people are in these camps in the west of China now?
Well, scholars have looked at this, taking that satellite data and construction tender data as well, to try and create estimates. And they believe that there are a million or more.
A million or more people in the camps now. And, you know, going back to kind of that first set of documents, what was also interesting is that you found that some of the people who had to carry out the policies of taking people and putting them into camps, it wasn't that easy for them. There was kind of some internal dissent.
That's right. I mean, aside from the leak of the documents themselves, there were signs within the documents of officials who resisted. In one case, there's a detailed description, and he doesn't really seem to be doing it for high-minded ideals. He just thinks that it's not going to work. So it seems like internally there's also a sense that this program is not working.
All right, Austin Ramsey, The New York Times, joining us via Skype from Hong Kong. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
While digital disruption has upended the business model of the music industry, some artists have managed to harness the technology to forge careers without promotion from old-fashioned record companies. One of them is Mac DeMarco, whose self-produced records and unique persona have allowed him to thrive in today's environment. NewsHour Weekend's Christopher Booker has more.
The irreverence that infuses the music and career of Mac DeMarco has been there from the beginning. She might not love you anymore. From his initial 2012 breakthrough, DeMarco stands as a portrait of the artist unpolished. A contemporary musician not afraid of the overshare or being misunderstood, whether posting photos of his double chin or appearing as a lizard man smoking a cigar.
I mean, I know what kids like on the internet. You know, they want to see my double chin. It's funny. I think it's funny, too. It's no problem.
For the Canadian-born singer-songwriter dubbed the laid-back prince of indie rock, the transparency has endeared him to millions of fans, making him a staple of the touring and festival circuit. But DeMarco's success is as much about his ability to go it alone as it is his musical talent and offbeat personality. Everything he does is self-produced and self-recorded, either in his bedroom or this cluttered, gear-filled garage in Los Angeles.
Did you train in recording, or is it all trial and error?
Oh, I don't know. No, I never took any... I have no idea. I mean, I just kind of would get recorders and stuff like that and do whatever I could on them. I mean, I still don't really know what I'm doing. I know how to plug stuff in, and I know how to like set a studio, and I understand the basics of, you know.
DeMarco's understanding of the basics is how it started. Living in Montreal at the time, he began uploading his songs to Bandcamp, a website that allows musicians to sell music and merchandise directly to consumers. He was signed to independent label Captured Tracks soon after. His first two releases in 2012, an EP called Rock and Roll Nightclub, followed by the full-length album, too, produced tens of millions of streams of his music and videos. His video for My Kind of Woman from his album, too, has 35 million views on YouTube. While his song, Chamber of Reflection, which comes from his 2014 follow-up, Salad Days, has been streamed over 96 million times on Spotify. And this past summer, with the release of his album Here Comes the Cowboy, released on his own label, his basic understanding produced a bona fide Billboard hit.
Here Comes the Cowboy.
Here Comes the Cowboy was your first top U.S. top 10. It did really well.
Yeah, but what does that mean? Jack squat. I mean, it's cute, I guess. Everyone that works with me was like, right on. I guess it means we sold some. But it's like the Wild West. Nobody really knows what's going on. Everybody's freaking out about things getting monetized, and everyone's, you know, talking about streaming services, you know, social media, blah, 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 blah. Nobody really knows what's going on.
Nobody, except maybe Mac DeMarco. His fans, like most these days, are overwhelmingly consuming music on streaming services like Spotify or iTunes, which pay only a fraction of a penny per stream. But if your song has been streamed over 96 million times, like DeMarco's Chamber of Reflection has, that's still real money. Not to mention an endorsement that your approach might be working, something that for DeMarco has remained largely unchanged and happens nearly every single day in his garage, recording song after song.
I like this. Yeah. Just garbage, but fun to make. Yeah.
Sounds like it. This could be like a Super Mario Brothers world, you know?
Yeah. That kind of stuff. What else we got? What's this? Hippie Rip? Similar vibe. Just, you know. I think the thing for me is sometimes I get more preoccupied with the recording side of things, so I'll just make something just to see how I can record it. So, you know, but that's nice.
What do you mean? Make something just to see how you can actually
Like instead of sitting down and being like, well, I should write a song today, it's kind of like, well, I'm just going to do some like little, you know, really rush through something just so I can put the mics up, you know? It's like, it's just the nerdy side of me coming out.
Okay, we play the show now. Let's go.
If it all feels kind of tossed off, well, it is. And DeMarco is well aware that he's the one who might get tossed off any minute. But he says whatever happens is whatever happens.
I mean, I have it set up so I could make albums forever. Like, you know, there's no... I'm not paying anything to be in here. I'm not even paying for tape anymore. So it's like I can just reuse the same one over and over. And it starts sounding real sketchy. But I'm really at a point right now where I feel like I'm, you know, not... I just feel calm. And I feel like I like... making art, and I'm gonna make the art that I want to make, and I don't really care if people like it or not. On the level, see me out of
high, stand up like a man.
Finally tonight, NewsHour will have the latest on the NATO summit, the UN climate conference, and Wednesday's House Judiciary Committee impeachment hearing on air and online this week. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for watching, and have a good night.